The universal health insurance mandate. It's constitutional. And that means the health reform law stands. Now for the hard part. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Thursday, June 28th. It's either a national holiday or a day of national shame, depending on where you sit on the political spectrum. Of course, it was all about health insurance reform this morning. But we've got some other interesting stories for you as well, including the possibility of crop damage as another heat wave sweeps the Midwest.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
In a 5-4 decision with Chief Justice John Roberts the key vote, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld President Obama's Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. The U.S. economy that's been preparing to implement this giant law can carry on now, basically. Marketplace's David Gura was at the court for this morning's opinion, and he heard the decision. He's here to help break it down. And David, first of all, the linchpin of all of this is this mandate that all Americans must carry health insurance. So by what essential reasoning did the court say this individual mandate is upheld?
The court was grappling with two constitutional issues here, Jeff. The government argued that it has the ability to do this because the Constitution gives it the power to regulate interstate commerce. And the second argument the government made was this and the penalty for not buying health insurance, which is a pretty small amount, Jeff, constitutes a tax. And the court said that the government cannot use the Commerce Clause to back up its position, Jeff, but that tax argument does work.
And that's all it takes, apparently. The court also said states cannot be forced to enforce the mandate by the federal government by threatening to withhold existing Medicaid money. Have I got that right?
That's right, Jeff. So essentially, the court has said to the states, look, if you disagree with expanding Medicaid, it's up to you to decide how you want to proceed. And here they were wrestling with something pretty thorny. The government had said in the law that if states did not comply, they could lose some existing Medicaid funding. Today, the court said that would be unconstitutional, but Congress could decide to withhold future funding if states don't enforce the mandate, Jeff.
So hospital stocks, at least, are rising on this news. Will this generally be greeted as good news, you think, by the healthcare industry?
Well, I think that the outcome is pretty positive for them, generally speaking. I mean, since this mandate stands, Jeff, we're looking at millions of Americans who are going to get health insurance, and that's business, of course, for the insurance industry.
So there were a lot of people, and will remain a lot of people, who are opposed to this law. What's next for those opponents?
Well, the court has spoken, and there are plenty of people, as you said, outside the Supreme Court who are angry at what it said. David Almazi is one of them. He's with the National Center for Public Policy Research.
Well, I think that the only thing the American people can look to now is across the street here at the Congress, is that they have talked about repeal. They've pledged to have a vote on repeal, and I don't think they can do it soon enough.
I should say he was holding a sign that read, Jeff, "Don't tax me, bro." And what he says really sums it up, that this is out of the courts, it's a political issue now, and today's decision all but guarantees this is going to be an even more central issue to this election.
Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. Thank you very much, David.
Thanks, Jeff.
For more analysis on the health reform decision, now we've got healthcare economist Uwe Reinhardt. He's at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Thanks
My
for being
pleasure,
with us.
Sir.
So the court made an important distinction here about whether this can be considered a tax, which they say is fine, or whether it's justified under the Commerce Clause. Does it really matter to you as a health economist exactly how we split that hair as long as the mandate is in place?
As a health economist, it really doesn't, because the mandate was in effect written not really to be a mandate, but rather a choice. You can either get insurance, or if you don't buy insurance, you're going to pay an amount that is close to the actuarial cost of what you represent in case you get sick and don't have money and burden hospitals with your costs.
Mm-hmm.
In oral arguments, they suggest that actually it's in the nature of a tax because it gets administered through the IRS. So in a way, they wanted to have the cake and eat it too, and they got it.
And the important thing, if I understand you correctly, is that the incentive is in place, whatever you call it. That incentive, this idea of a mandate, has been in place in Massachusetts for a while now. Is the mandate working there?
I think it is working from all I have read. Now, there are always opponents who say it actually isn't working. It's driving up health insurance expenditures and so on. But I think by and large, you measure it by how many people remain uninsured. and that's plummeted in Massachusetts. So most people actually obeyed the mandate and took it up.
Do you see this as a conclusion of sorts? You know, we have the law, and now we've got what we need for reform. Or is this just a piece of what ultimately needs to take place, in your view?
Oh, no, this is a work in progress. I liken it a little bit. When we were young, we bought unfinished furniture, and it was sometimes a little rough. Some nails had to be tapped in, and then you had to sand it and paint it. The Supreme Court could have just taken the axe to it and smashed it and say, this whole thing is no good. Mm-hmm. They didn't do that, but they say it survives. But since this bill never went to a reconciliation in what is called conference, this bill has a lot of ugly corners in it that need to be sanded down. But that can be done through legislation. We, after all, did the very same thing with Medicare. Medicare has been amended many, many times.
Professor Uwe Reinhardt, an economist at Princeton, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, as usual, here at the Marketplace Morning Report, we've been up from well before the crack of dawn and well before the healthcare decision. So just a quick disclaimer here. We want to bring you a couple of good conversations that we had leading up to when the Supreme Court issued its opinion. And first, my Morning Report colleague, Jeremy Hobson, talked with former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. Jeremy started off by asking how Senator Daschle thought the decision was going to come out.
Well, we know this. They'll make history. And we know also that they're going to have a huge impact today with whatever decision they make on the way health care is provided in our country for years and years to come. Beyond that, it's almost impossible to predict.
Well, let's go with one possibility then and see what would happen next. Obviously, if they say that it is constitutional, then we know what happens. If they say that part of it or all of it is not constitutional, what is the next step for health care reform in that case?
Well, there's a number of things, frankly. It's still going to be a matter of public policy, so you're going to see the Congress involved. Obviously, between now and the election, I don't think much is going to get done. But beyond that, you've still got a good deal of power within the administration and within the Department of Health and Human Services to carry out a number of proposals. You also will have a significant amount of additional activity at the state level.
Do you think that there will be, let's say that it's declared unconstitutional, do you think that there is going to be another move, let's say President Obama gets reelected with a Democratic Congress, to spend a year putting together a new health care reform package?
I don't know that there's going to be the kind of consensus around a new proposal that quickly. Ultimately, I think what you're going to see is that Congress is going to move away from the Commerce Clause to their taxing authority. They've already mandated two things under their taxing authority. They've mandated retirement insurance through Social Security, and they actually have mandated Medicare health insurance through Medicare Part A. So we've mandated on the other side, and that's never really been seriously challenged.
Well, do you think it was a mistake then not to use that same authority to mandate people buying health insurance and instead use the Commerce Clause?
From a constitutional point of view, we'll know today. But I don't know that we'll know anything more than that. Obviously, it was a safer move. Whether it was the right move, only the Supreme Court will now tell us.
When you look at the polls, this law is not very popular in any of them. How do you think that happened? How did this law, which was aimed at helping the American people get health insurance, become so unpopular?
Well, I think, first of all, it became heavily politicized. And because it became so politicized, it became a Republican-Democratic thing right out of the box. So there you lose half. Then you've got a tremendous amount of effort on the part of many of the conservative media, Fox News and the radio pundits. They have all chipped in. And then finally, you've got the arbiter of credibility, the judges themselves, some very conservative judges declaring it's constitutional. Unconstitutional. That three-step process had a lot to do with people's perceptions changing dramatically over the last couple of years.
What do you miss about your time in the public sector, if anything, at this point? You've been in the private sector for a while.
Well, to be honest, I miss the power. The senators have an enormous amount of power, probably second only to the president of the United States. You miss that. You miss your relationships. You miss sometimes the excitement, the intensity. But there's a lot of nonsense you don't miss as well. So I'm perfectly content to be where I am.
Senator Tom Daschle, former majority leader of the U.S. Senate, now a senior policy advisor at the law firm DLA Piper. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
And for an international look at the healthcare decision, I talked with the BBC's healthcare correspondent Dominic Hughes in the U.K. He said there is definitely interest in this beyond the U.S.
Well, it was reported actually on our morning news this morning. And, you know, it's interesting watching the debate in the States from here, where we have obviously a taxpayer funded National Health Service, which has undergone a lot of shakeups over recent decades, but the most fundamental reforms in recent months, which many critics of those reforms said were transforming it into something more akin to the US system. And people here really value the National Health Service here. And, you know, we see that from patient satisfaction surveys have been at historic highs in recent years. People are very fond of the National Health Service, and it's something that politicians here in the UK meddle with at their peril.
Now, not to imply that Americans give a rip what anybody else thinks, but let's say the law falls, as some people expect. What are Europeans going to take away from that result in terms of their view of us?
Well, I think people will view that as, you know, there is this inbuilt fundamental conservatism about the United States, that's kind of the message we get over here, that people really do not like the state to interfere with fundamental aspects of their lives. And there is this resistance to that, no more so than demonstrated in healthcare. And they do not want, the view we get is that people in America do not like and do not want, you know, the government encroaching on more and more areas of their lives. So there is this hostility, we see a hostility towards the government trying to create a sort of national healthcare system, which to our minds is, you know, is hard to understand given the sort of affection we generally have for the National Health Service.
Dominic Hughes, the BBC's healthcare correspondent, thank you very much.
No problem.
And on the cusp of this big Supreme Court decision, it's a perfect day for what we call an attitude check.
And the latest poll number suggests margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Attitude Check is our weekly partnership with Gallup. Editor-in-Chief Frank Newport is here as always, and quite a day, huh, Frank?
Quite a day indeed.
So is this a decision based on your polling that is in tune with the American public?
No, it's not. Most polling has shown at least a tilt against the Health Care Act in general, so the decision, which will be interpreted in the headlines as supporting it, will not be. A couple of recent polls by a 7-point margin, an NBC Wall Street Journal poll found people would be more disappointed than pleased if it was upheld. This was prior to today, but that's what the polling showed. A Pew Research poll showed by a 12-point margin people would be unhappy rather than happy if the Supreme Court upheld the entire law. So that pre-polling certainly indicates that the reaction of the American public is going to tilt more negative than positive, although we're going to have to wait and see what happens.
Right. Americans have been glued to this certainly for political reasons. It's very interesting as politics. Did they think the outcome was going to affect their lives directly?
I don't think so, because the polling has shown that Americans don't think the entire 2010 Affordable Care Act is affecting them in its entirety, regardless of this decision. So it's upheld. But our polling and others has shown that Americans say so far it hasn't affected them. And we've asked Americans to project, do you think when all the provisions are put in place, it will have a major impact on your life? And a lot of Americans say, no, it won't. So I don't think personally Americans are saying this is would be something like the threat of taking Social Security away. A lot of Americans think this act isn't going to affect them personally.
Well, very glad to have you with us as always. Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of Gallup. Now, amid all of the politics and the polls around healthcare, we have a new poll. This is from the National Geographic Channel. Two-thirds of Americans believe President Obama is better suited than Mitt Romney to defend us from an alien attack. That's a result that cuts across gender. So once this healthcare thing blows through, you can look for that to become the top issue on the campaign trail. They also asked people which superheroes they would most prefer to swing into action if aliens attack the planet. And the Incredible Hulk, interestingly, came out on top. And researchers in Japan have developed a robot whose function is to beat humans at rock, paper, scissors. And if you haven't seen this video, you should check it out. It beats the human every single time, 100%. How does it do it, you might ask? Well, the robot has sensors that monitor your hand's movement so quickly it can react within a millisecond and beat you. In other words, the future of robotics appears to be cheating, at least in Japan.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Hospital stocks rose on the health law decision, but bad banking news and a contentious Eurozone summit dragged down markets, at least through the morning. Major U.S. stock market indexes are down more than 1% as I speak to you just this moment. Part of the problem is this number, $9 billion. According to unnamed sources in the New York Times, that could be the true cost of losses from bad derivatives bets at investment bank J.P. Morgan. And that's 4.5 times the estimate CEO Jamie Dimon discussed last week with Congress. One more number for you, the number 2. That's how many pieces News Corp plans to split itself into. One company for the cash cow film and TV businesses, another for the struggling newspapers. The board of News Corp and Chairman Rupert Murdoch have approved the move. This week, Stockton, California is set to become the largest city in the United States to file for bankruptcy. It's been negotiating for months with creditors, but it could not close the budget chasm. But there is life after Chapter 9, and you only have to look about 70 miles away from Stockton. Here's Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji.
To a city north of San Francisco called Vallejo.
Living it up in Vallejo, California.
Best known for B-list rappers, a Six Flags amusement park, and filing for bankruptcy in 2008. Vallejo City Council member Stephanie Gomes says, with bankruptcy came opportunity.
To open the books and show all the problems and admit to them and address them, it was a unique opportunity, I think, for a city.
Gomes says Vallejo took the respite from debt to figure out where to cut and ways to boost revenue, and it passed a 1 cent sales tax to pad its bare bones public services. James Spiato is a municipal bankruptcy expert. He says bankruptcy is just a Band-Aid unless cities address their real economic problems.
With Stockton, the economy, the housing crisis, the need for additional jobs, that isn't solved by a Chapter 9.
Vallejo's Stephanie Gomes says 4 years after filing for Chapter 9, her city is still grappling with its biggest problem, the cost of pensions. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Tens of thousands of people have evacuated from the Colorado Springs area because of a raging wildfire that's threatening homes. And it's just one of many wildfires burning across the West, thanks to especially dry conditions. Now, those fires make for some dramatic images. But as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, the real drama for many of us will come because of the effect that dry weather is having on farms.
The regions of the country hit so far by this year's hot, dry weather look a lot like the drought of 1988. That struck hardest in the farm country of the lower Midwest and caused over $60 billion in damages. This year, corn farmers are already feeling the heat. Corn futures have climbed 28% in the past 2 weeks in anticipation of a depleted harvest. Phil Plord follows markets at Blimling & Associates. He says beef, pork, chicken, and dairy farmers will have to pass on the higher cost of feeding their animals.
Corn touches a lot of things. You can see it affect the livestock sector. It's in a lot of food products, sweeteners. So if we're talking about high corn prices, the reach can be pretty broad.
This drought began in Texas in late 2010 and has so far cost corn, wheat, cotton, and hay farmers over $7.5 billion in lost sales. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Now, we've been so focused on the Supreme Court all day, let's not overlook the basketball court. The NBA draft is tonight. Basketball teams are crunching numbers on players. But picking a player isn't just about the stats. Interview skills and personality count as well. So potential draftees have been learning how to present themselves in the business world to help their chances. Andrew Parsons reports.
Tonight, Bernard James is in the NBA draft. He's been interviewing with teams for months. James is 27, and that's old for the pros. But he's been using his 7 years in the Air Force to his advantage.
I've been in pressure situations in the military, and I know how to handle myself. That's what separates you from everybody else.
After the military, James went on to be a star center for Florida State. He's not at the top of any NBA team's list, so prospects like James hire trainers not only to build muscle and speed, but to practice how to be a good candidate, telling stories, making eye contact, and being confident.
You'd be surprised some of the things they take for granted, like what to wear in the room, and, you know, is a hat appropriate when you're going in an interview where millions of dollars are at stake.
Steve Schenbaum is the founder of Game On Nation, which hones athletes' communication skills. He says character matters. General managers don't want drama or egos to weigh down their franchise.
There's stories out there now where they're asking the cab driver, how did that player react to you and how did they treat you?
Tonight, Bernard James hopes that he's made an impression that sends him to a top team, despite his age. I'm Andrew Parsons for Marketplace.
And finally, you know how when you take off a watch or a ring, sometimes it leaves an imprint on your skin for a while? So one company is taking advantage of that with what it calls the anti-cheating ring. It's a wedding ring with the words "I'm married" engraved backwards on the inside. So when you take it off, for whatever reason you might take it off, your finger is imprinted with the words "I'm married" for a while. The ring's made from titanium, which, as the Daily Mail points out, may be a little stronger than the vows it's supposed to represent. This has been the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles, coming to you from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.